Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 3, The Truth of Bliss, No Genesis Nor Final Destination.
People understand something by trying to understand how it was produced. You're like, you want to understand this lacquer, little lacquer box I have. You want to know, you're like, I bought it in Burma, like they have a little wooden frame, then they lacquer it with coats of lacquer, etc. And then I feel like, oh, I know what that is, I know how that's made. Then they might get into like how the lacquer is made out of the leaf of some bush, etc. You know, the wood came from something else. And they go back and back in a chain of creation causations, right? And most cultures, which deprive beings of their true freedom and also the danger of their true responsibility, come up with some creation story, right? They all have. And then the creation story, oh, God did it. God takes the blame. And then there's some priest who enforces that, you know. And then one feels in a sense secure. And then also one is under the authority of that idea. So Buddha's thing is you analyze life, and you go back through all these mental things and you come up with the origin of it, which is ignorance, actually. All right? And by thinking through those 12 patterns, those 12 links of the domain of what is called relativistic origination, you finally realize, in a way, it's teaching non-origination. It actually is teaching emptiness. Because if the world is created by ignorance, the world as we experience, the world of suffering, that means that in reality it isn't created. It's just, it actually is nirvana. It always has been. But ignorance has made us think it's this. And then, of course, people think of it, well, it's a creation analysis, so it must have a temporal thing, you know, because it had to start at some beginning.
But you know? That's what I was curious about, is that it, you know, starts.
But the fact that it starts from ignorance, that fits in the place of the beginning, and of course ignorance is not a beginning. It's just a mistake. But the point is, it's a way of freeing, the 12 links of the a way of freeing the mind of the person trying to discover reality from some absolutized origin myth, is what it is. He has another sutra, the Buddha Tao, where he called the Aganya Sutra, the Sutra of the Beginning, where he talks about the beginning of this cycle of this universe, but coming from previous universe. When this planet blows up, in the far future, all the beings' consciousnesses who are engaged with this planet by their biology, by that time, they reach into a second plane of the form realm, of a certain heaven plane. And everybody's like an angel, and they hang out, squabbling around as angel, and then they're for, you know, billion years, and then and then they come back as humans, and they just keep fighting and slugging it out, you know. And that again is a deconstruction and a reconstruction of the idea of a Genesis theory, and which is always connected with kingship, right? The Mahabharata, the ancient India, Vedic idea of kingship was the king is almighty, is the arms of God, you know, and the king can do no wrong, etc. And the Buddha said the king is the first cop. He's just an elected cop. His name is Mahasamatha, the great elected one. And when things deteriorate to a certain point where people are bothering each other, they hire one guy. They give him a percentage of their harvest so he doesn't have to plow. And they have him protect each of them from each other. You know? So if he doesn't do that and he exploits them, he can be bumped. It's like a theory of revolution, actually.
So it's not a foil in any way for the tantric process of creating oneself?
No, although, you know, the Chakrasambhara Tantra, which is the one I call the Super Bliss Machine Tantra, he has 12 arms. But I've never found in a text to explain it. And these 12 arms and the implements that he holds in them symbolize the cessation of each of the 12 links. Like you cease ignorance. You know, the way the aura originates is you are ignorant. Then you have like mental surges and functions. Then you have consciousness. Then you have name and form. Then you have the six sense media. Then you have contact. Then you have craving. Then you have feeling. Then craving. Then grasping. Then existence. Then birth. Then death. Then sickness and old age. It's like a chain. So you stop ignorance. That stops functions. That stops consciousness. That stops, they go through the 12. And the things he holds in his arms are the symbols of the 12 links. Well, when they do the not born means not born involuntarily in a suffering state, and reborn in that state. And they emphasize that to give, because why? Ordinary people cannot imagine, when they think realistically, that we are right here, sitting here, we are beings, our bodies are made of light, actually, and the ground is light, and everything is light, and we're just configurations of bliss. La la, you know? You say that, oh, bullshit, what do you want to sell us, a drug or what? You know, you can't imagine that. Such a struggle. Life is such a struggle. I mean, you guys are young and you're great yogis and you're healthy. I'm like, I really realize that now I'm old and decrepit. I get up and without meaning, I go, you know. But I'm not really in pain, but sometimes I am if I've been sitting cross-legged for too long. But, you know, it's just the struggle. So then somebody comes and says, oh, you're made of light and you're bliss. Yeah, sure, man, you know, whatever. So they're not going to, you know what I mean? He can't jump there, you know. So there's all these ways of leading people to open their mind, et cetera, and then kind of get back to it, you know. Everybody has experienced the clear light of the void many times. Every time you died, you experienced it. They say even when you sneeze, you experience it. When you have an orgasm, I hope everyone's had one, you experience it. But just a tiny little flicker of it, you know. And Buddhahood is where it's a constant state. It doesn't even seem ecstatic, like what we would think of as sort of ecstatic, which is just the first opening into the thing. It's like what everything's made of. So then they can, without being sort of unsteady or unstable, they can be, you know, they can open or make a little box or something while in total bliss, you know, and seeing that as a piece of bliss. But that's, to get there is a huge thing. And you can get out of the suffering. That's the first thing they tell them. And then most people imagine that getting out of the suffering means getting out of life, because life is a struggle. And in a way, I consider it as like the concept of God, actually, in theism. You know, you have this unconscious feeling of that you have a separate self inside. It's the human psychosis, the animals too, animal psychosis. And why do we can't, you know, that Bob is in there, there's a little homunculus that's Bob that is not affected by all the pains and problems of Bob. But that's the real me. We all imagine that. In that sense, we're all a little psychotic. That was Buddha's thing, Buddha's discovery. And once we're like that, life is troublesome. Because we imagine that there's a space in here which nothing bothers us. It's not connected. The soul is like different. We can't wait to die. But then we can't find the soul. We can't find that place that isn't affected by anything. Because to find it, you would have to affect it. When you see something, you contact it. It contacts you. It relates to you. You relate to it. Right? So then you go back. If you go into yourself, you think you found something. Oh, I'm just about to get my real Bob. Then it disappears. Oh, no, but I'm the one who's looking for myself. So we feel that way. So then I didn't find it. I can't find it. It actually isn't there, but I feel it's there. It sort of gives me a sense of security that my real essence is separate from whatever. I'm losing my hand has arthritis or something, you know. And then I say, well, the world is so difficult. But, oh, there's one guy who's outside the world, and it's just a kind of game, or we don't know why. And we're in it, but eventually he'll take hold of us by that piece of us that we can't find, that it isn't here, because it's not relative, and take it up in the great non-relativity. You know, so we project the psychosis into a psychotic God, who's not connected, who's not responsible for the evil and suffering in the world. Although he creates it and is omnipotent. You follow me? And so we create a psychotic nirvana, or what the Hindus call nirvikalpa samadhi, which is a psychotic state. Oh yeah, I disappeared there and that was my real self and it really never was here. Excuse me. That guy that some lady cooked his like chapatis for him for 50 years and he's samadhi and I never was here. Oh no, that's all Maya. You wash the dishes because it's Maya and your dishwashing is an illusion and I don't care. Because I'm disappearing. Oh, and then, I'm hanging around after I had the disappearing experience as a holy man. But when I die, then I won't have this body to drag me back down, and I'll be in permanent disappearance. Because there is an absolute disappeared state somewhere, which I found out how to get to. But that's the real me. That's completely neurotic, that idea. And there's versions of all spiritualities that focus on that, including Buddhism. Because the ordinary person pushed too much, like, you know, who has this sort of little bit psychotic way of defending themselves from their sensitivity of pain and their fear, there's something completely free in me that's disconnected from everything else, and you just come and just swarm over them with universal relativity, and you're connected forever, and everybody's your mother, and you gotta be everybody's mother, and you gotta be an infinite Buddha and take care of them all forever, forget you. They can't deal with that. So then, but the beautiful thing about the Buddha's psychotic nirvana is that when they get there, because there's this no self thing hanging there, and he refuses to say what that nirvana is, it's sort of like a failure to launch. You know, they're samadhi and they're launching and they go through all these states, and then they kind of. The selfish drive that wants to get out of and into some place where they're just by themselves with nobody bothering them, it kind of weakens in those states. They don't misinterpret a state of disappearance as the absolute, because they have the, which is very difficult not to do, because when you have a realization of nirvikalpa samadhi, it is really powerful. The whole thing seems to disappear, and that seems to be really real. And so it's a momentum of compassion. And a momentum of critical analysis, really remembering without words at that stage, because there's no verbalization at that stage, remembering that any state that there was an entry to is relational. That's really understanding emptiness. So therefore, it's not an absolute. And then that brings you back from it, and you don't get attached to it and become a deity of a formless realm for 2 billion aeons, you know. Miss out on your aunt, you know, and fail to meet your yoga class. You know? So then that non-duality then brings you back to being committed to the art of transforming life around you in a positive way. You're stuck with that. You suddenly are completely embedded in it, and taking away that psychotic escape energy gives a certain kind of powerful energy to it, where it's blissful and you have the energy to get it done. I mean, because you don't have to get it done right away. You can die a few times because you remain conscious through all of that process. You do lucid dying, like lucid dreaming. You can learn to do that by practicing lucid dreaming and by doing that.
You've talked about an ocean of energy.
Yes,
today.
Right. Yes.
And yesterday you talked about, I think you used the phrase, an underlying goodness to everything.
Yes.
Are both of those synonymous with the clear light?
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
So the clear light is the substratum of everything.
Well, no, it's approached from being trapped in a world of constructed entities that we think are intrinsically objective. The ignorance-constructed world. And then it seems to be a substratum of that. But actually, it is all of that. It's not. It seems to be at the base, like when you die, they have this thing about layers of consciousness, and then you come to clear light. Even when you sleep, you go to clear light. But that's just because we're stuck in our habitual perceptions of the ordinariness of the world. In reality, it is all of this. But it's not a substratum. This is made of that.
So is it a...
And it doesn't do anything itself. It isn't creating that. It's not like an omnipotent creator or something, because it doesn't do anything because it's infinite. But our ignorance draws on it, actually. And then it's there. It can be drawn on infinitely because it's infinite.
So is it absolute? Does it have what?
Well, it's beyond concepts of absolute and non-absolute. You know, it's like inconceivability. It's in the area of inconceivability. So it's not non-absolute, it's not absolute. It's non-relative, it's not... But it can be approached relatively, let's say. It can only be approached relatively because it is absolute relativity, which is a paradox. You know? So there's an element of, finally, of inconceivability. You know, but then in the Vimalakirti Sutra, not even in Tantra, they say Bodhisattva living in the inconceivable liberation can pick up a universe and throw it like a frisbee across multiverse and then catch it again and put it back where it was, just like throwing a frisbee or a boomerang. And the people on the universe don't even know anything happened. People in the different planets on the universe don't even know anything happened. Or, you know, then the whole planet, another thing is the whole planet can fit into a mustard seed without the planet being smaller or the mustard seed being bigger. So then you get into sort of miracle area as you get more toward how everything's made of clear light. Prabhasvara. And Prabhasvara also is used, it's a name that is used for the top seven Brahma, Kaika, Deva heavens. In the realm of pure form. There's 16 layers of the realm of pure form. The very topmost one is called Akanishta, and that is on the boundary of the speed of light because it's where mass becomes infinite. And therefore it moves into the formless realm, the realm of pure space, of infinite space. And then that becomes the realm of infinite consciousness. That becomes the realm of absolute nothingness, which is just a constructed realm. Of course, nothing. It's not nothing. It's a realm of absolute nothingness. And then beyond that is actually what the Hindus call Turiya, and which they think is the final destination. But by Buddha putting them as the four formless realms, he's clearly saying these are the abodes of form, disembodied deities who have a subtle energy body that they don't think of as a body, and they get trapped there, but they're peaceful. But they're trapped there, and their evolution freezes for billions of aeons, and they don't develop the body of Buddhahood, of enlightenment, where they are infinite and yet engaged in everything in infinite bodies. Well, when you're Buddha, you're not just Kira in one body, you know, who's like can be do something with one or two people. You can deal with everybody with millions of bodies, supposedly. At Dalai Lama, there are millions of Avalokiteshvaras. He's just one institution. But, you know, Karmapas and Avalokiteshvara, there's millions of them. And Taras, my God, the place is crawling with Taras. They have the 21 major Taras, they're all over the place. And people have a vision, you know, people do have visions where they suddenly see, you know, every leaf, every piece of bark in the tree is filled with Buddha verses. People call them Buddha fields, I call them Buddha verse, as opposed to universe. I coined that word. And I think it'll stick. It'll be in Oxford posthumously. Other translators don't like it, but until I die, they'll like it. But while I live, they wouldn't want to accept it.
This podcast was brought to you in part by the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. We weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogail. All rights reserved. Thanks for listening, and please show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to this weekly podcast.